All right, here we go. Good morning. Welcome into the show. Bill Ryder with you. We have a great program lined up for you. We're going to get into how Kevin Stefanski is actually the guy Cleveland is setting up to fail. That's even more true today. I'll explain in about 20 minutes. Trey Hendrickson and the Bengals have found an agreement of a kind. It is a temporary Band-Aid, but he will be on the field this season for Cincinnati. That is an organization, historically cheap, that you can kind of, if you want to, make the case, have put their money where their mouth is this year, to a degree. Hendrickson's deal is a basically one-year raise. He'll still be an unrestricted free agent next season. We'll get into the implications of that. We'll talk about Dave Portnoy being banned, not just from Ohio State's hallowed home grounds. Maybe every Big Ten venue this year is part of Fox's college football coverage. Micah Parsons, I've got a TV recommendation, a TV show recommendation that many of you will listen to and Ryan Hickey will ignore. Speaking of Ryan Hickey, he was at the U.S. Open last night, so he's going to give us a little U.S. Open tennis report. If we have time, I want to get to this. It's really interesting. We'll visit about the ways in which NIL in college sports, one of these unintended consequences things, how NIL has fast-tracked freshman quarterbacks to the front of the line, has required younger QBs, highly paid, hard-to-land, top-tier quarterback recruits to play early. Maybe too soon. This year will be a test of that. We'll talk some baseball with CJ Nikowski. We'll do buy or sell. We'll take your phone numbers at 888-710-4ISN. But today, we start with the news out of Cleveland that the biggest obstacle, the biggest problem, the largest contributor to Shedeur Sanders failing, if he fails, is going to be Shedeur Sanders supporters. Let me explain. So yesterday the news came down. Good news, it seems, on the face of things for Shedeur. It is good news. Kenny Pickett, one of the four quarterbacks in that crowded quarterback room. Remember, Joe Flacco is going to be the starter. Pickett had been the number two until he got traded yesterday to the Raiders. Then it's Dylan Gabriel was three. He moved up to two in the quarterback room. And there was Shedeur Sanders looking for a spot on the 53-man roster, which locks today at 4 o'clock Eastern, 1 o'clock here on the West Coast. So the good news on the face of it is that Pickett going to be the backup in Vegas means we know what the quarterback room at the start of the season in Cleveland, one of the most interesting, volatile, toxic questions in football, has been resolved. Flacco will be the starter. Dylan Gabriel, they feel like they saw enough that he's the number two. He's the actual backup. And Shedeur Sanders, in a vacuum, which is not where he lives because of the name on his back and the silliness of his supporters, but in a vacuum, Shedeur Sanders lands exactly where he needs to land as a potential future quarterback of impact, as a just recently drafted fifth-round QB, and that's the third stringer. That's a guy who's not ready but has potential and now, in theory, has time. Turns out, Andrew Bogish, I thought, put this very poetically yesterday on his X account. Bogish not here today. He's over on our New York affiliate, Gordon Damerson. But it wasn't just Bogish. A lot of people correctly pointed out, oh, what happened to their setting Shedeur up to fail? What happened to the preseason reps that he got were a highfalutin plan to get rid of the guy? What happened to they don't want Shedeur? It turns out that the noise and the toxicity and the ugliness and the accusations and the drama, the diva-like gravitational pull of Shedeur Sanders doesn't come from Shedeur Sanders. That dude's done everything right. That guy's been a pro. Has he been phenomenal as a football player? No. He's a third stringer who was drafted in the fifth round, who's having to adjust in a significant way to what he was asked to do at Colorado under his dad in college versus what you have to do at the National Football League. Guys who are drafted number one overall struggle with that transition. Of course Shedeur, as a fifth-round draft pick, was gonna struggle. Now, the takeaway from yesterday's news, and it's good for Shedeur, is that the biggest problem for Shedeur Sanders is going to be Shedeur Sanders fans. Because I haven't seen many of them, and I went and looked. And we name-checked a few of them yesterday. We played a few of them on the air. I haven't seen anybody do what never happens in media today. And you know what? That's not fair to my media friends. What never happens in America today. People just say, I was wrong. The I hate it, and I'm sure it has an impact on me professionally. I hate social media. I think it's stupid. I'm so tired of assessing whether a good politician or radio host or policeman or anybody is good at their job because of whether they're good at social media, as if that's the real world and the other stuff isn't. But the reality is that nobody, because social media, it, and you know this, it bends and contorts our view of ourselves. And so I'm going to pick on Shadur fans, but it could apply to a lot of people. These Shadur fans who made it known that Shadur Sanders was being undermined, the Browns want him to fail, and they want him out of football, and Stefanski is A, B, and C, designed to get rid of Shadur. Pretty quiet yesterday. Pretty quiet when the Browns, and I'm not saying Kenny Pickett's a superstar. He's not Patrick Mahomes, but you want a reliable backup quarterback in the National Football League. You know what that looks like? It's a guy who's not very good. That's why he's a backup, who has played and been around enough to understand if you are in an emergency, how to step in. And you're probably going to have that emergency in Cleveland because Joe Flacco's 110 years old. He just is. And it turns out the Browns did have a plan. They saw enough from Gabriel, who they drafted, as you know, in the third round of this past draft, ahead of Shadur, to be the backup. And they saw enough from Shadur to be the third stringer. This is a vote of confidence in Dylan Gabriel, first and foremost, but in Shadur Sanders as well. It's two rookies who back up a 40-something-year-old QB. But you're not going to hear that from the Shadur guys. You're not going to hear that from the Shadur supporters. And they're the problem. They're the issue. I made this Tim Tebow comparison yesterday. And there's not a lot, I don't think, that is similar about Tebow and about Shadur in terms of how they play and just their college careers were different. Tim Tebow was at the powerhouse under Urban Meyer during his collegiate career and played at an amazingly high level. I think the most successful collegiate career probably in the history of the sport. But what is similar is that each of their levels of potential greatness, the way that they're interesting, the way that they're dynamic, the way that they are, well, you know what they are? They're celebrities. They're celebs. Herm Edwards said this yesterday. They're not just quarterbacks when they came out, Shadur still. They're massive celebrities. It bends the physics of how we interact with these guys and view these guys. And all sports, all team sports, turn away from and grimace coaches, front offices, at the idea of a guy, individual, being bigger than the team and being disruptive. But that's especially true in football. Shadur didn't do that. Every time Shadur is interviewed, barring maybe one ill-advised, youthful mistake, confrontation with a radio host in Cleveland, he says the right thing. There was the contrived controversy of Dylan Gabriel supposedly taking shots at Shadur when he really didn't. And Shadur was a pro about it. So nothing I'm going to say here is a criticism of Shadur Sanders. And if I, by not calling Shadur Sanders a guaranteed version of Patrick Mahomes or whoever you want me to point to, makes me a hater, shut your faith. I mean, I'm just going to like be quiet. Stop. Yesterday's news that the Browns are moving on from Kenny Pickett is great news for the stability of that team. It undoes some of the drama. It shows their confidence in their two rookies of varying degrees. But the main thing that it does is it just showcases if you are listening, if you are, thank you, appreciate you, love your loyalty, glad that you're here. If you're one of the people that was making the argument to your friends on social media, screaming at the radio at me, that the Browns were out to get Shadur Sanders, it's time you say the most important thing a human being can say that nobody says anymore. You were wrong. You bleeped it up. It's okay. We all make mistakes. I thought the Bears were going to win 18 games last year, and it's a 17-game season. It happens. For Shadur, and this isn't going to, the problem for poor Shadur is that I thought the biggest obstacle to his success, the ways in which teams, and we saw 31 of them do this, we saw 32 of them do this until the fifth round when the owner probably stepped in. I thought teams were going to shy away from Shadur because of his dad, frankly, and the name on his back, and the attention naturally that we, the media, are going to bring to things like that. I'm guilty of it, and that's to a degree true. But the biggest problem for Shadur Sanders is you, Shadur fans, is your toxic response. Okay, so he gets very standard reps in preseason games in a crowded quarterback room for a Browns team and a coach who have to win. Stefanski, the fifth most likely coach to be fired this year, by the way, according to Vegas. So there's some pressure. Shadur gets all the normal opportunities, and the sky is falling. You, the conspiracy theorists, are out for blood. You want Stefanski's head on a pike. You want him fired. You want him gone. You want him banished. You want him to coaching lacrosse somewhere in Sioux City, Iowa. It doesn't even deserve to be in football. What's going to happen when a third-string quarterback doesn't get a lot of reps or get a lot of opportunities, or we don't see him again because it's the regular season. There's football being played. What's going to happen when Flacco struggles a little bit and there's a little bit of talk in week two or three or four? If the Browns are 2-2 or 1-4 or 2-5 about the backup coming in, and God forbid the Browns decide maybe if they go that route, maybe they'll go with the number two quarterback. That's Dylan Gabriel. And everyone, oh, they hate him. They're out to get him. This isn't going to end. This isn't going to stop. The problem for Shedeur Sanders is you, Shedeur fans. It is hard to become a successful NFL quarterback. Time, a little bit of anonymity, the ability to grow, support from your teammates, barring resentment. Another reason Tebow failed, a big reason he failed, not the only one, is because his teammates, and I've talked to guys who were part of this, and some of whom have admitted this later, like you Shedeur fans need to do, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to be wrong if you can admit that you're wrong. There was a lot of resentment toward Tebow. Guys that had worked seven times as long in the National Football League, who had families, who had put in the pain, didn't understand why this kid was a celebrity when he couldn't even make the starting, couldn't even be a starter. That's going to happen to Shedeur too, because of you, Shedeur fans. Aaron Rodgers had 3 years of relative anonymity behind Brett Favre. Patrick Mahomes had a year behind Alex Smith where the only people who knew about his greatness were his teammates. Instead of resenting him, they marveled at him, but he got to do it quietly behind the scenes. Let me go down this list. Shedeur hasn't been afforded that. If he can't play preseason games without it being a national emergency that requires the National Guard to come out and forcibly remove Kevin Stefanski, according to Shedeur fans, how is he going to have the opportunity to grow, to try and succeed by sometimes failing? If I'm Kevin Stefanski, it doesn't matter what Shedeur Sanders' ceiling is. It's not worth it. He's actually, I think, Kevin Stefanski, been pretty gracious in dealing with Shedeur. And in fairness, not with Shedeur, with you, over-the-top, overzealous Shedeur fans. You were wrong. It wasn't a conspiracy. You were wrong. They weren't setting him up to fail. You were wrong. And look, this isn't just, this is people in the media. Our guy Emory Hunt, who we played yesterday, going on CBS Sports HQ saying this is a Stefanski problem. No, it wasn't. There's a great expression, and I think it speaks to this. It is easier to fool a man. I think it's Mark Twain. It's easier to fool somebody than to convince them that they've been fooled. You fooled yourself. You fooled yourself into thinking that Shedeur wasn't starting because of some grand conspiracy by the National Football League and Kevin Stefanski and the Illuminati and the aliens. What are they, like lizard people or something? I can't keep up with all the... And all... Or Bigfoot. Or the mermen. Is that a thing? I don't know what you're thinking. You're wrong. He's not good enough yet. That's fine. He's not ready yet. And the very difficult, very fraught path from rookie quarterback to successful NFL player is made a lot harder when you Shedeur fans start screaming and yelling and calling for jobs because he in the preseason, as the fourth quarterback at the time in a quarterback room, isn't anointed the future of the franchise. Give me a break. By the way, I already knew this. Rational people knew this. And we're not all, look, we're all irrational on certain things. I'm not even mad at you for your bad take. I'm mad at you for your silence. Because I wanted to see on X, which I know doesn't happen, the same amount of, oh, I got this one wrong as I saw the ridiculous flood of contempt 24 hours earlier. Kenny Pickett's trade is great news for Shedeur. It's great news for Dylan Gabriel. It might even be good news for Kenny Pickett. The Raiders aren't exactly bursting at the seams with excellence. Maybe somebody will get hurt. He'll get a chance. I don't know. I don't even care about Kenny Pickett. Why am I pretending? Have fun in Vegas. Go to the Bellagio. It's still great. Old school. The trade, though, mostly just illuminates the way in which this toxic idea of my guy has to be the guy or everyone else is a terrible human being has taken over sports. And shame on you, Shedeur fans, because you've been unfair to Stefanski, you don't care. You've been unfair to the Browns, you don't care. You've been unfair to rational people who look at this as football and not something else, you don't care. But you've mostly been unfair to Shedeur Sanders. And you put him in a position where no other football team is going to want to deal with this garbage. And the thing is, now that you've done this, if he does get cut, if he can't start, if Dylan Gabriel turns out to be really good, and even Shedeur behind the scenes looks like he's outstanding over the next few weeks or months or years, other teams are going to pause at bringing him in because of you. Not because of Shedeur, Not because of a conspiracy, not because they hate him, not because they hate his dad, because of you, Shador fans. You're the problem. And unless you collectively do what nobody does, and you apologize, and you say the words, I was wrong, and you just back off, and you let the dude just have a little space to try to grow into being a quarterback in the NFL as a third stringer with a massive name on his back he already has to carry, he's going to fail because, at least in part, of you, not Kevin Stefanski. 888-710-4476. I'm supposed to give you the letters first. 888-710-4ISN. 888-710-4ISN. Seriously, it's okay to be wrong. By the way, this annoys me about radio hosts, too. It's not just you if you're a Shador fan. And we have this opening that we just, well, we're nice here. I'll admit I'm wrong. I will admit when I'm wrong. Is it easier for me because it happens very rarely? Yes. But I'll still do it. I'll still do it. It turns out, I do swing and miss sometimes. Jalen Brunson, that guy can hoop. My bad, my B. There aren't many of them. But the ones that are out there are out there. It's all right to be wrong. It's all right to love the people you love. I love Mark Grace. My favorite player growing up. I used to pretend he was a Hall of Famer. He wasn't. It's okay. Doesn't mean because I was wrong about Mark Grace that Will Clark also sucks. It's an old school reference, but it's my emotion. I can't really, yeah, it's my emotional reference. We see this in the LeBron-Jordan debate, too. We see this in the Mahomes thing. Oh, Mahomes isn't that good. Okay, man. You can love Josh Allen and still Mahomes can be good. There's room for both. You can love Shador. And you can recognize and accept that he's not yet ready to be the quarterback you want him to be. And that by going after anybody who recognizes that, especially with the Browns, where they are invested in his success since they literally drafted him, going after them just undermines your guy. 888-710-4ISN is the phone number. I'm going to give you a quick just theory of mine on why actually it's Kevin Stefanski who's been set up to fail. Much more. Shador hasn't been set up to fail. But I got to get into this Trey Hendrickson news. The impasse is over. He and the Bengals have come to an agreement of sorts. It's really interesting what it says, not just about Cincinnati's plans this year, but what happens in the future, because those are different things. There's a fork in the road coming up, and we're going to get into it next here on Writer Than You.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast. Welcome back to Writer Than You.
You better let him know that Librarian Hickey won't work because he doesn't read. That's the joke, though.
That's the irony.
It's like calling Mike Samter Biggie.
Exactly.
You know?
Or a fat guy Slim. Like, it's just, that's how
right.
It goes.
Right.
You
know?
Fat guy fat. Hey, fat
it's like
though.
Calling me ugly. No, it didn't work.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
Welcome back. Welcome back into the show. Bill Ryder with you. Good news for the Bengals. I'm not sure it's great news. I think this is a to be determined on the long term, but Cincinnati, in coming to an agreement with Trey Hendrickson, has at least gotten themselves into a position where their critical pieces are going to be on the field this season, in which they're good enough on paper to certainly contend. Let's not start 1-4 if you're Cincinnati as a general game plan, but this is very good news. So the gist of this was, Hendrickson was, and by the way, remains, on the final year of his deal. He was scheduled to make $16 million. He was unwilling to do that. They were trying to figure out a way to extend the contract. The sticking point here was the guaranteed money. He wanted some. They didn't want to give any, is sort of where we were. And so he was facing the idea and the notion of not playing this year. Usually these things get decided. We're now at the point where only Micah Parsons remains, and in a normal world with a normal organization and a competent owner, that deal would also get done between now and next Thursday when the Cowboys get going. We'll see. Maybe that incompetence will override things. But in Cincinnati, clear heads prevailed. It's just a weird deal. He's going to make $14 million this year. Sorry, he's going to make $30 million more this year. I'm good at math. 16 more. So it's a $14 million raise. Let me do that again. He got a $14 million raise to get to 30. There's a $1 million bonus in there as part of this if he plays 60% of the snaps and Cincinnati makes the playoffs. So he's getting paid for this year. It's good money. He is, what, the sixth highest paid player at his position. He is the fourth guy in Cincinnati to make $30 million or more money this year. They've already paid other dudes. They're committed. They're invested. He's almost certainly going to be an unrestricted free agent next year. And while technically Cincinnati could franchise tag him. That amount would, if it was this year's numbers, come in at $36 million, which they wouldn't do. He's, what, 30? Going to be 31 in December. And so this is probably a last ride for Trey Hendrickson. And the thing is, I know that the knee-jerk reaction is to find how Cincinnati screwed it up. That was my initial reaction when the news came down, because they tend to be cheap. They have not, I think, covered themselves in glory in this situation. But the fact is that they get one of the three or four best players defensively, probably in football. He had 17 and a half sacks last year. That accounted for a huge percentage, almost half, basically half, 48.5%, almost half of his team's sacks last year. Trey Hendrickson got himself. They get him on the field while he's still at a high level, but we know that as guys get into their 30s, especially in this game, especially at that position, age can start to catch up to you. 1 minute, Von Miller's a machine and an absolute beast. The next minute, he's older. It happens quickly. Kind of like running backs, especially when they're more valued 10, 12 years ago. I don't hate this for Cincinnati. I don't hate it for the Bengals. They have a guy out there who's a game wrecker, and their weaknesses, they have two major weaknesses. One is that they start slowly at the start of the year. That's a Zach Taylor problem. He's got to figure that out. That it's not a Trey Hendrickson issue. But the other is they're not particularly good defensively. And in that situation, what you need and what you require is a guy that can come in on the defensive side and be a game wrecker. The Chiefs have had a better defense the last 2 years, but there was a time when that Chiefs defense wasn't good, but Chris Jones was often a game wrecker. And you would see this especially in the playoffs, where the Chiefs defense would be 22nd or 23rd, and the idea was, man, if they could just get to a different level of mediocrity, and they eventually did that in the years ahead, they could consistently win, make Super Bowls. This is at the early part of the Chiefs' run. And before they got that figured out, before Spags, the defensive coordinator, got things humming the way that he wanted, they weren't great defensively, but you would see Chris Jones at times just take over games, just attack the quarterback and single-handedly destroy defenses. There's not a guarantee that'll happen. You're walking on a high wire there if you're relying on one guy. That is certainly true in Cincinnati, but Trey Hendrickson is good enough to do that. Doesn't mean that he will. Opposing offensive lines are going to double-team him. They're going to find ways to try to basically work around him or past him or over him or through him, whatever. He's capable of that level of excellence. And so Cincinnati gets him. They paid their receivers. They made Joe Burrow happy. Obviously, Burrow's handsomely paid. I like it for the Bengals. I like it a lot. And next year, and hopefully, knock on wood, Trey Hendrickson's healthy, he'll go out, he'll get overpaid by a team like the Chicago Bears. He'll play really well for a year and a half at 31, 32, and he'll get the guaranteed money that he wants, and he'll probably hit a wall like a lot of these guys do. I don't want past failures to complicate what is a success. You can be bad at running a football team and make a good decision. And I think that's what the Bengals have done. I think everybody wins, but Cincinnati wins a little bit more. They'd offered a three-year, $95 million contract with no guaranteed money. And in effect, they get kind of the same thing. They get the 1 year of Hendrickson. Because if they wanted Trey Hendrickson to be locked down for past this year, they would have paid him. They obviously have made an internal calculation. It's a gamble, but this is what you do in sports. You don't know. Every time you draft somebody, you're making a gamble. It's going to work out. You draft them with the first overall pick, you're making a bigger gamble. You draft them with a fifth-round pick, Shador fans, you're making a lesser pick, a lesser gamble. They've made a gamble, and they made this when they just said, we're not going to guarantee money, that he was mighty valuable this year, and they think not worth the risk after this season. And you know what they got? They got him this year, and they're not committed to him in the future. They're going to pay him $30 million, but they're not going to have to guarantee $60 or $70 or $80 or $90 million. I think Cincinnati wins here. And I think Trey Hendrickson, it's to be determined. Ryan, they're not. Good morning, by the way, Ryan Hickey.
Good morning,
I almost
Bill.
Called you Ryan Hurley. That's our boss.
That is. I'm not the boss.
You're not Ryan Hurley. That's the boss.
If you want me to be the boss, listen, I'll boss you around.
Will you? I'd like to see it. I told you this morning to tell me to shut up, and you wouldn't even do it as a joke.
Well, because I'm not the boss. If I was the boss, different circumstances.
I like it for the Bengals.
Same. And I like that at least it seems like they acknowledge they're in a win now window. Like Joe Burrow is still young enough where you could argue, okay, maybe, you know, we'll take our time and our window's a decade long and whatever we're going to kind of just go through. We'll fight and we'll stick with Trey Hendrickson. I'm not going to have a sense of urgency for this year. Getting it done, paying him, I guess seemingly caving this year, we're also winning in the long term. It does seem like a win-win for the Bengals.
Yeah. If I'm Joe Burrow, it's hard to be frustrated. Ja'Marr Chase got paid. Check. T. Higgins got paid. Check. And if you're Burrow, I mean, Joe Burrow's job is not to worry about winning in 2026, next year, right? So as it relates to this season, Trey Hendrickson got paid. Check. And so you've got, you've got to motivate. I mean, I think Trey Hendrickson's enough of a competitor. You don't have to worry about that. But it is interesting. $1 million ain't nothing. Can you imagine $1 million as a bonus? Anyway, $1 million as a bonus. If the guy plays 60% of the snaps this year and the Bengals make the playoffs, that is it's a really smart way to structure that because obviously it benefits Cincinnati. Here's the other thing. If Trey Hendrickson plays 60% of the snaps and the Bengals make the playoffs, Trey's probably having 12 or 14 or 18 sacks. It also means he's going to get paid at the end of the year. And so this is by somebody else. And I don't think it'll be Cincinnati. This is an everybody wins kind of deal. It's good business by Cincinnati.
I know we're going to do our NFL picks next week, but do you have a lean or do you feel strong about your prediction when it comes to the Bengals for this year?
I don't. I think I'm probably going to lean toward overvaluing them.
And betting on basically their defense won't be as bad as it was last year. Can't get any worse.
They do have the advantage. We're going to have Nick Wilson on more this year, by the way. My guy who's a radio host in Cleveland, and he may push back on this. I think he's going to come on next Wednesday. They do have the advantage as it relates to the slow starts. They start Browns, Jags. Those are very winnable games if you're an elite football team. And I think that they are an elite football team. To answer your question, I am highly tempted to take the Bengals as my second best team in the AFC this year.
I would agree in the sense of that. I think the Steelers will be down compared to past years.
It's Bills, Ravens, Chiefs, Bengals in some order.
Should be. It should have been last year. I mean, we had that order last year, too, and their defense crapped it. I agree with you. The defense should be better this year, so that should be in the conversation. I mean, they have the offense. There's no doubt about that.
Three of their first four games are on the road, though.
I just looked it up. Joe Burrow's career record against the Browns, for the most part, Browns have been pretty bad in his career. He is 3-5.
Does he play them early in this? It is very weird how they can't win early in the season.
I think it was 2 years ago when he had the injury-riddled season. They lost. It was either week one or week two in an ugly fashion. Like that defense has his number. So I would agree, on paper, they should be 2-0, like no doubt about it. History says right now otherwise.
I mean, if you want to be a pessimist, right? At Cleveland, host Jacksonville, at the Vikings, which are such an interesting question mark this year.
Very.
J.J. McCarthy. At Denver.
That's tough.
A lot of people, and that's Monday Night Football, a lot of people are high on Denver. The altitude's a thing. That's a thing. Host Detroit.
Oh, wow.
At Green Bay. Host Pittsburgh. I mean, the first 7 weeks.
Wow.
They could be 6-1 or 1-6.
And that almost,
they won't be 1-6, but I'm.
Now you have to, like, you almost, with that schedule, after the first two games, you have to go 2-0.
You have to go 2-0. And then you get some momentum, right? So let's say you win the first two games. You go into Minnesota. Maybe your momentum, because we've seen the Bengals when they get sort of in their groove later in the season, they are elite. So you kickstart that early, and that is if you're playing a really good Vikings team, maybe you still win. Maybe J.J. McCarthy sucks. We don't know. You love it when I say that word. I don't know why. You always get amused.
Because it just sounds so strong and biting. Maybe he sucks. Maybe the guy's just the worst quarterback we've ever seen in
maybe
ever
he is.
Played a position. It's possible.
I mean, how much has that dude benefited from a just national media perspective and pressure perspective from Shedeur Sanders? All these other quarterbacks who are struggling or struggling to prove themselves, Cam Ward should send Shedeur a thank you basket of whatever, chocolates and whatever people, crackers, cheese. I get these sometimes for Christmas from former bosses. So nice. Go, I'm a little cheese in here. I don't know what this is. It's soft French cheese. That's crazy good. Don't even know how to say it, let alone order it at a grocery store. They should. We got on a tangent. It happens. All right. I know you hate it. I love going through NFL schedules sometimes. By the way, the Bears are on there in week 9. By then, they'll be rolling.
Who, the Bears or the Bengals? Who are we talking about here?
The Bengals. I mean, at Pittsburgh, at Baltimore, at Buffalo. I mean, obviously, Baltimore, you're going to play twice. I mean, it's like, I don't know, dude.
But road games against three of the toughest teams in your conference is not easy.
It's not easy.
That's tough.
And the NFC North, I think, is really good, although I can remember years when we thought the AFC West was going to be amazing, and then it would just be one team that was good, and that team was the Chiefs. So you never know with divisions. All right, Ryan Hickey went out to, what is it called? Is it Flushing Meadows?
Flushing Meadows, yeah. The Billie Jean King Tennis Center.
Billie Jean King Tennis Center, I should have known that. All right, Ryan went out there, we're going to get a U.S. Open tennis report after a sports flash from Gordon Damer.
Infinity Sports Network. Sports Flash.
Bill, the Sports Flash is sponsored by Progressive Commercial Insurance. Your small business keeps you on the go. Progressive Commercial Insurance keeps your policy within reach with our easy-to-use mobile app. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. 4 p.m. Eastern today. That's when NFL teams have to cut their rosters down to 53 players. Some teams not waiting until the last minute. Isaiah Simmons cut by the Packers this morning. Former 8th overall pick back in the 2020 draft. Signed a one-year deal with Green Bay this offseason, but he's now looking for work. Other recognizable names cut loose. The Browns releasing wide receiver Deontay Johnson. Steelers cutting ties with DeMarvin Leal. He was their third-round pick back in 2022. And the Giants, they have cut Tommy DeVito, the quarterback, now looking for work. And Trent Brown, released by the Texans. From baseball, Mariners one game back of the Astros in the AL West. Padres one game back of the Dodgers in the NL West. Seattle, San Diego face off again tonight. Dylan Cease, Luis Castillo on the mound there. And men's top seed, Yannick Sinner. He is among the players playing their opening matches later today at the U.S. Open. I'm Gordon Damer.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast. Welcome back to Writer Than You.
CJ Nikowski on the show. I'm trying to look up your stats, but I can't find it. How many
don't
times
do that. You'll end up in a bad spot. But I will tell you what Tony, I want to say he was one of the few that I knew. I'm going to probably exaggerate, but I think it was 1 for 10 with a handful of strikeouts.
Just so you know, if you want to give Tony the little head nod, the little like, you know me, he was 2 for 14 against you. You struck him out 5 times. He never hit a home run, and the only hits he got were singles. You dominated that Hall of Famer, bro.
I appreciate it, bro. I remember the one broken bat.
Well, you've earned a little. What's up, Jim? If you want it. I'm just saying, like, you have permission from me if you need it, if that's something you need.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
All right, welcome back into the show. Bill Ryder with you. CJ Nikowski, Jim Tomey, killer, dominator, destroyer of worlds will be on the show about 16 minutes. Kevin Fulitar tweets at me at SportsReiter. Shador has been a breath of fresh air. He talks God and positivity, and that's exactly what Cleveland needed after Watson. It's mental stability through the noise. Give him time to study and get reps in practice, and maybe in a year or two we can stop playing quarterback carousel in Cleveland. That is the most rational perspective on Shador Sanders that I've heard in a long time. I will say this, Kevin, not arguing with you. Anyone who follows Deshaun Watson is a breath of fresh air. Even Ryan Hickey would be a breath of fresh air. How you doing, pal? Ready? Are you ready for this? Do you want an intro? There's no music, right? Because I didn't ask you again. But I got a little. I'm going to do a little. Okay. And now it's time for the Writer Than You U.S. Open Tennis Report with Ryan Hickey.
Wow, the crowd's going crazy. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Great intro.
Is this your
Bill.
First time out at the old tennis center?
Yes. First tennis match of any kind I've ever seen in person, but especially at the U.S. Tennis Center to watch the U.S. Open.
What a debut. All right, tell us about getting there, the vibe. I want the whole thing because I've never been out there.
Getting there is very easy because it's right across from Citi Field. So same, you know, bunch of trains, easy to get to. Basically, you go right for the tennis center, left for Citi Field. Mets were playing the Phillies yesterday, so packed. A lot of energy around that area, which is nice.
You take the subway. The 7 train.
7 train right to Queens.
Got it.
Nice and easy.
How long is the walk when you get out of the train to the tennis center?
About 5 minutes.
That's not bad.
But straight, just like basically one long boardwalk.
Okay.
Get in there. We got there. Night match. We went for a night session. Night matches start about 7. Venus Williams is on. We got tickets to the main court. Venus Williams is first up on the main court. She got going about 7:15, 7:30. We got there. Let's see. We got there about, walked in about 6:15.
Okay, early.
Packed place. There had to be 100,000 people there in the
grounds. They showed a view from the top, and I was shocked by how many people were in there.
The grounds are huge. I think there's 17 courts in total that competitors are playing at different points throughout the day. So just a lot of people there in general. There's screens all over, so if you don't have tickets to the main arena or you just kind of want to walk around, you can watch a bunch of different matches. So that was very cool.
Can you go to that stuff without a ticket? Could I just roll in and go to the public grounds?
You need a ticket to walk onto the grounds.
Okay.
But those, I'm sure, grounds tickets are a lot cheaper than, you know, the main stadium Arthur Ashe tickets.
What'd you pay for good seats? Can I guess?
Well, they were not good seats. We were pretty high up.
All right, I'm going to guess. 70 each.
It was, I think, about 90.
Okay, I was close.
90 each, which worked out because we saw Venus Williams, and then we saw Carlos Alcaraz for the night session.
I love Carlito.
So in terms of big names early on, too, I think that's a good deal, I will say.
What was harder to watch, watching Venus lose that third set or watching Carlos walk out with that haircut?
The haircut was shocking.
Shaved his head off. Shaved his hair off. He didn't shave his head off. Shaved his hair off.
Shaving his head off and then winning a match would be very impressive to do.
That would be amazing.
The haircut, I would say, was shocking because I'll be honest with Venus. I just thought we were going to see two sets. I thought she was going to get smoked. She's there. You know, just right. To be able to say you saw her in person is cool. She's playing, I think, the 11th ranked player in the world. Didn't really expect her to compete. So winning the second set and just getting to a third was very impressive, unexpected. So when the kind of the wheels fell off and she got dominated, I was like, oh, you know what? I think we got our money's worth.
Do you know how old she is?
44.
45.
Wow. You would know better. I don't think she plays really outside of...
No.
Right? So like,
Look, not every tennis player loves tennis. You have to do this from childhood. I know guys that have played professionally who have fallen out of love with tennis after they've retired. And most of them come back to it. I think she just loves the game. I think she just... 45? She just ran out of steam in that third set.
But it's at that age, it's tough. Yeah. And all the miles she's been playing for, right? Basically, since she's... I mean, all these players are playing since they were very young, but catches up to you after a while. It's a lot of... Now I see what you kind of go through, getting a bird's eye view. It's a lot of running, a lot of stopping, back and forth, up and down, side to side. It's a lot.
This idiotic view that it's not a sport, it is such a competitive, difficult... So you basically run 2 or 3 miles per set if you're playing singles. 2 miles per set.
Which is crazy.
So you're not a tennis, and then you saw Carlos, who I think is the most exciting player in the world. Was there an energy to his play, like were people mesmerized, even though it's an early round and it was clear he was going to win?
Yes, there's definitely like a palpable energy. The arena filled up, even though I think it probably got started 10:15.
Night?
Yeah,
that's late.
Well, Venus goes 3 sets. They had, for whatever reason, in between the 2 matches, they gave the Tennis Hall of Famers that were inducted for the 2025 class, including Maria Sharapova, their rings. So that ceremony took...
She used to live right by me.
Really?
Yeah. I think she moved.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Please continue. Sorry.
So she was there. So it was like 25 minutes that added to it. So that by that point, it's like 10:15, the match starts. But there's still a lot of energy, comes out, big roar. Like, again, at least I try to watch U.S. Open specifically now more the last few years because I think it's interesting. And you can definitely, even on TV here, when there's an American playing, everyone there, no matter who the opponent is, roots to the American. He's, like, I think, the only person I've ever seen where the American's on the court and people are not rooting for the American.
Was he playing against an American?
Yes.
Oh, that
poor Riley dude. Opelka.
Oh, he played Opelka.
Who's 6'11".
Yeah. Like, yeah, and he has a huge serve.
We were way up top, and this guy walks out like, this guy's huge.
He's huge.
You could see from where we were, basically, in the nosebleeds, how tall this guy. Yeah, the serve was like 140.
Yeah, I've seen him, where I play tennis, he's been there a couple times in the last few years hitting in the lead-up to the tournament that's in Palm Springs, so guys will be in the area because it's close. He has a huge serve.
If I gave you 20 opportunities to return a serve of his... At 140 miles an hour, I think you can do it.
I'm a really good return of server for a 4-0 tennis player? And I think the answer is no. I've always wanted to ask Andy Roddick to serve at me, but I think he'd hurt me. I really think he would just...
just hit it at you?
I think he'd body serve me. Yeah, I really do. Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, I don't...
Alcaraz had trouble with... like, he probably had, in the three sets, 20 aces.
I bet.
He was just... I mean, also a ton of double faults. He was going for it. But
I didn't watch that match. So Carlos... but Carlos broke him one time each set, right?
Yeah, I mean, his problem was he had a big serve, but also could not return any serves at all. So... he won almost every game he served, Opelka did, but
one,
Carlos won every set he served, plus one. It was like,
he broke,
I think it was 6-4, 7-5, 6-4 was
that's
the final
exactly
score.
Right. So, one break per set.
Right.
All right, so as a non-tennis guy, because I have friends who fly out to the U.S. Open from L.A., how does it feel as an event for someone that's just like, you know, like not obsessed with tennis the way that some other people are?
Very cool. Again, like I watch maybe the majors, I would 100% go back. And I would love to go back to a bigger match. I think that was the only thing that's tough when you go early on. It was awesome to see some big names. But like also the level of tennis is not great because it's such a big mismatch. Right? There's not a lot of big volleys. There were some good ones and like the crowd gets into it when it's like four, five, six hits.
Right.
But when it's aces or just one return and done, like it's tough to get into. So if you go like, you know, in a top 20 match, let's say in the quarters or whatever, and you get some good rallies... they always talk about like the U.S. Open crowd being like the most electric. I think that would be like, if you
especially
go later,
Opelka. Because Opelka's going to
cool.
lose every point,
right.
except when he serves, he's going to win that immediately.
Right. Yeah, there's not much tension.
Any other observations you made?
Anything
else stick out to you?
The clientele that attends, maybe the U.S. Open, I don't know if this is true for all tennis events, but at least the U.S. Open.
Okay.
I'll say this. If you're a single guy and you can afford to go to the U.S. Open,
okay.
I would definitely go.
So you're saying that the scenery...
talent.
Okay. But if you're a single guy, are the people you're describing also single, or are they with rich dudes?
Both. I think there's enough...
okay.
There's enough quantity to where if you're single and you're just walking around having a good time and you're social, I think you could do A-okay. Buy a honey deuce for someone and be, you know, go from there.
Thank you for the tip. I liked it. Have you been to a professional golf tournament?
I have.
Which do you prefer?
I like tennis in part because it's all like enclosed and like you're kind of watching the main people there. Where golf is all spread out.
It's a lot of work. A golf tournament. You got to walk here and there. You got to try to get an angle to see the
Do you run ahead to see? Do you want to see the green? Do you want to see the tee shot? Where can you stand? It is right. Or at least tennis, you're sitting down and you get the same angle.
Won a U.S. Open tennis report.
Next year, at Pennsylvania, we'll do a little Rider Than You remote from New York City live at U.S. Open. Let's go.
Let's talk to Ryan and Dave about a little expense account.
In.
First class only, though.
Only the best for the best.
Only the best for the best. CJ Nikowski is going to talk some baseball with us next here on Rider Than You.
You're listening to the Rider Than You podcast.
All right, good morning. Welcome into the show. Bill Rider with you. We are very lucky to be joined by CJ Nikowski, Atlanta Braves TV color analyst, host of Loud Outs on MLB Network, 10-year Major League Baseball pitcher, former colleague of mine, and a gentleman who owned Jim Thome, the Hall of Famer, in their matchups over the course of his career, which I remember from last time we talked. CJ, what's up, buddy? Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Yeah, I don't brag about that necessarily, right? You do something good against a really good guy, you just kind of walk away and be grateful you had a little bit of success, but definitely no smack talking on my end.
Not on your end. I'm bragging for you. I'll if I see Thome, I'll say something. No, I won't say anything to him. I'll just say, hello, sir. How are you today? Speaking of guys having ridiculous offensive years, do you have a particular lean here when you've got a guy like Cal Raleigh who's just been an absolute beast versus someone like Aaron Judge, who's, you know, doing the same sort of things for a perennial powerhouse like the Yankees? If the Mariners win that division, does that become the difference maker, or do you just look at their stats in a vacuum?
Yeah, so I'm not a proponent of MVP having to come from a winning team. I believe that whoever the best player is the best player, and that certainly can be debated. There's been a lot of back and forth in that over the years. I could argue that it's just as difficult to put up good numbers when your team isn't winning. Obviously, the Mariners are right there, and they're going to have a chance. But even if you're on a bad team, and you put up big numbers. Doesn't mean it's easy. There's nothing easy about playing in the big league. So I've never taken team success, in my opinion. I'm not a voter, obviously, but into account when we talk about the most valuable players of the league. I think if anything for Cal Raleigh, what will stick out more is the fact that he catches. And there is obviously a much bigger physical demand on a position player when he is behind the plate, and not to take anything away from anybody else, but it's the most demanding position on the field. So for me, you know, if there's any points that he's going to get in his favor, it'll be for the catching side of it. Now, he does have a 10 home run lead, which is also pretty significant. They do have the same amount of extra base hits. But you sit there and you take a look at Aaron Judge, and I know we've gotten away from it, but batting average still matters to some degree. And where there's this big of a gap, and the OPS kind of follows with it, I think that works in Aaron Judge's favor. So I don't think there's a clear winner right now. It'll make the final few weeks of the season even more interesting, because this one for me is still up for grabs.
CJ, the Mariners are just one example of how much parity there is. I mean, there are a lot of teams who are still in striking distance of a wild card spot, or at least close enough that the games, right, if they get hot, even now, there's some meaningful baseball to be played. How do we get here, and how good is this for baseball that there's a lot of markets across America, and not just Chicago, LA, New York, Houston, that are playing meaningful ball right now?
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, I think it's a big part of what we got with the expanded playoff format, and who knows, maybe we'll go even further. Kind of Rob Manfred alluded to that when we get closer to expansion and getting to 32 teams. So that part has helped. I think the goal has been met in the sense that you have more teams that are playing more meaningful games down the stretch. Now, in the case of a division, obviously this is strictly about trying to win a division. And there's some good races, and the Mariners are right in there with the Houston Astros. The Rangers expected to be there. It's a little bit surprising to see them seven games back. I mean, there are some good teams that are not having the years that they anticipated, including the team that I cover in the Atlanta Braves. But I think parity has been pretty good. I think what's most important when it comes to parity for our sport is probably when you look at the different economics for certain teams, and then they still find ways to compete, right? Tampa, for the longest time, I know it's not necessarily happening for them right now. They're three games under, but you know, Tampa has always been a really good example. When the A's could contend, they're a last place team now, but it was a good example. You could do this with a lower payroll. And the fact that we have a race in the National League West between the Dodgers and the Padres are a couple of high payroll teams, but it's just a reminder that you can't just necessarily go buy yourself a division title. The New York Mets could, you know, talk about that conversation as well, as they're six games back of the Phillies. So there's some good parity, no doubt. I think teams have gotten smarter. They know how to make the most out of the resources that they have. But, you know, quite honestly, I feel like it could run even deeper. Like, the wild card races are not as deep as I wish they were. So while there's some good things happening, there are some teams that are having off years that are starting to cause some separation before we get into September as far as who's really contending for one of those wild card spots.
All right, CJ Nikowski, I've got a question here based on a theory, but if the theory is wrong, just correct me, okay? You are the expert. I'm the Braves, right, because I'm a Cubs fan. I spent my life watching the Braves and the Cardinals not win every year, but have the right organizational structure and the right culture from rookie ball all the way to the majors, and they've been perennially well run. So if I'm a Braves fan, I'm not overly worried. This year is not fun, but there's been injuries, and it's a well-run organization, and I feel pretty good things are going to be okay. If I'm a Baltimore Orioles fan, I might feel a little bit differently. Felt like a year ago we thought they were on the verge. They had this incredible farm system. Is there a lesson out of Baltimore about how to try to seize opportunity, or the right sort of cycle of your farm system when, you know, one minute you feel like you're top of the world and the next you're the bottom of the AL East?
So I think the thing with Baltimore that everyone kind of points to is when you get to that point where they've done such an excellent job of developing their own with the high draft round picks from the struggles that they had, when the moment comes to strike, to be confident in taking some chances. And I think that's probably where the hesitation has been, at least some of the frustration, I think, for those of the outside that aren't Orioles fans, as we watch it and cover it and say, you know, there's an opportunity for some big moves. And yeah, they moved a couple of their prospects, but they never really made the big move. And especially for them adding to the rotation. Now, they've had some bad luck like everybody else, and they will get Kyle Bradish back, but you know, they got a pretty deep rotation that's on the IL right now. Felix Bautista unfortunately hurt again, which was such a big part of that bullpen. So they've missed some pieces, and that's legitimate. But it's unfortunate, right? Because they had this nice run. They were a surprise team. They don't win a game in the postseason in back-to-back years, and now they're not, a postseason team. So there's some real frustration there for their fan base. But I think about kind of, and I know they're not operating with the same payroll, and it's probably not fair, and general managers don't like this comparison. But when you look at what A.J. Preller does in San Diego, he's clearly not afraid to make a move. He's clearly not afraid to move a really big-time prospect, and they did it again at this deadline. They took some chances with that Juan Soto trade and moved some really big pieces to the Nationals, like James Wood and Mackenzie Gore and C.J. Abrams and guys that are doing pretty well. It's tough to do, but it takes, I think, a certain stomach for it. And it feels like for the Orioles that maybe they just were not willing to make that big move with a big time player to put them over the top. And I think now, unfortunately, having the rough year, you start to look at, well, look, what's coming? Are they really going to do something big now? Will they make that big move? Do they have the ability to make that big move? It's unfortunate that I don't say their window's closed because all these players are really young, but they had some great momentum that got disrupted. And I think some of it is the fact that they were not aggressive come deadline time.
That's really interesting to me. I'm Bill Ryder talking to C.J. Nowakowski here on the show. C.J., Dodgers feel like maybe they've gotten to a better spot. They've beaten the Padres 4 out of 6 times over the last week. Not a secret that going back before that, really to the beginning of July, they had been really lackluster. And I'm in L.A., and every day I leave my house, I bump into Dodgers fans who are ripping their hair from their head. I mean, people have been very, very frustrated. Is that kind of a run against the Padres enough to say, okay, the ship has been righted, and the Dodgers are back where they want to be?
I don't think Dodger fans, just like any other fan base, will be satisfied until the regular season comes to a close and they've won that division. They know that they're out there. The Dodgers, even though it's only a one-game lead, are probably in a better position to be able to finish this thing off. I believe they don't have any more head-to-head going forward between these two when you look at the San Diego Padres and the Los Angeles Dodgers. So you don't get that opportunity. You mentioned it. They were great. The Dodgers were against the Padres. That helps. We saw what happened last year and how close it was, right? I mean, if the Dodgers don't win that series against the Padres last year and eventually go on to win a World Series, I think we have a much different looking Los Angeles Dodger team, including who's leading that team. I think there was some of that pressure. I don't agree with it, but I feel like it was there. But now you look at kind of the rest of the schedule here for the Dodgers, and they're in a really good position, right? They beat the Reds yesterday. They got the Diamondbacks, the Pirates, the Orioles, the Rockies, the Giants. I mean, that's their next few series. And again, they're all big league teams. Nobody's a lay down opponent necessarily, but I feel like it's tipped in their favor, even though it's only a one game lead outside of any more major injuries that crop back up. Playing better, like you said here lately, getting healthy, which has been really important, which will be a battle for them all year long and trying to get everybody back. They'll never get all the way there, but they're in a good position. And again, a favorable schedule. So I think they'll be okay. But yeah, it was a little touch and go there for a while. But I think, and I know they won't do it, but Dodger fans can probably relax a little bit. This should be their division.
CJ, I want to get into the weeds a little bit on their attempts to get healthy on the pitching side with Shohei Ohtani. He obviously has struggled, particularly the last few outings. And we've discussed this on the show, but I'm not an expert on this. You are. You pitch for a living in Major League Baseball. He's not able and wasn't able to go on an actual rehab assignment in the minors because obviously they can't take his bat. I mean, the guy's got 45 home runs this year, whatever people want to say about not at the same level last year offensively. You're not going to send him to Oklahoma City or wherever it is. What does that do to a pitcher? And I know Ohtani's unusual because he's hitting every day too, but if you're a pitcher and you can't go on a rehab assignment and your rehab has to be, even if it's an inning to start against major league hitting, how does that complicate things, if at all?
Yeah, it's a great question because you don't want to lose the bat, and it was very unique in what we saw, right? He ended up coming back a lot sooner than any of us anticipated. We thought he was probably at least a month away, and all of a sudden we find out he's going to, throw an inning. They did his rehab at the big league level, and it's not just, I think, how it affected him, but also the guys that were following him. I think Ben Kasparis was a guy that was kind of right behind him early on, and you're young and you do what you got to do, but he probably deserved to just have a straight spot in the rotation. So I thought that was a little tough on him, but it's a team sport and you do what's best for the team. But it's unusual. There is a trend in the game where we see less and less rehab assignments, whether it's position players or even pitchers. Guys try to skate it. They don't want to do it. I don't necessarily agree with it. Again, this is a very unique situation with Ohtani, but I think it was 2 years ago we saw it when I was with the Rangers. And Max Scherzer and Nate Eovaldi were guys that just preferred to try to do their rehab if they could at the big league level. And when you're fighting for a spot if you, especially if you're playing from behind or you're holding on by a game, to say, listen, we got really high quality innings and we're going to go let a guy throw two or three in the minor leagues. Why don't we take the two or three here in the big leagues and then just have somebody kind of piggyback that guy? I don't love it because you're not as relaxed. You can't work on some things, right? If you're sitting there in a rehab and saying, got to get my curveball right, you can't just go throw eight in a row in a big league game the way you could in a minor league game, right? The win-loss doesn't matter in that spot. So I'm not in favor of seeing less rehabs, but this was unique. And we all get the impression that Shohei Ohtani kind of calls the shots on how things were going to be done. If you like symmetry, and I do, to see him throw an inning the first two innings the next two, three innings the next three. Now he's pretty much been at four the next three, but you mentioned that they haven't gone particularly well. I think he's actually tried to go deeper. This is the plan that they have put in place or that he has put in place, and these last two have not been great, but this is the way they decided to do it. It's the uniqueness of Shohei Ohtani, and there's no roadmap for it.
CJ, injuries are part of the deal, and they suck, and they're a bummer, but they happen. If you're the Phillies and Zach Wheeler goes down now for the rest of the season, how do you recalibrate their chances this year?
I think they're still in a pretty good position. There's no getting around the fact that this hurts. It's a big deal. You know, he was having a Cy Young caliber type of season, and the award that has kind of alluded to him, and I think he was pretty focused on trying to win one this year. Now you get more concerned about, you know, his future health, his career. This is, you know, serious when it comes to the thoracic outlet syndrome. For the Phillies, they still run pretty deep. I mean, it's not the way Dave Dombrowski drew it up in the sense that he planned on having Zach Wheeler at the top with, you know, Sanchez and Luzardo. Suarez is a really good postseason pitcher and has been. And Aaron Nola's back. And though Aaron Nola's not having a great year, but, you know, they do still have five. And Taiwan Walker's done a nice job kind of bouncing back as well and holding his own. There is no replacing Zach Wheeler when you get news like this in late August because of the way it works. You can't acquire players. It has to happen from within. I think, if anything, this puts, I don't want to say pressure, but it kind of puts the onus a little bit here on Aaron Nola, right? It's been two starts and he's been back. The first one did not go well. His last one a couple of days ago went a lot better, where he went six innings, gave up a couple of earned runs, and punched out six. So he's the guy that they haven't had since May. He's the guy that's going to have to step up now and kind of get back to where he has been, and you just hope for the best. But yeah, they're short. It absolutely will affect them come postseason time. There's something about having aces that can throw for you in the postseason that make all the difference in the world, and the Phillies right now are down an ace.
CJ, last quick one for you. I'm curious, as you get to the end of the year, if you're a Major League Baseball team or you're a player, does it matter? Would you rather go into the playoffs with consistency over the course of the season, with momentum at the end of the year where you just get in? Is there any significance to how you finish September as it relates to what's going to happen in October?
So I learned this. I've always been a guy that felt like I wanted momentum. I wanted my guys playing well going into the postseason. And my last year covering the Texas Rangers and doing television for them completely threw that theory out the window for me because they limped into the postseason. They lost a division on the last day of the season. They got shut out 1-0. All they had to do was beat the Mariners once and they would have won the division. It didn't happen. The Astros ended up winning that day and taking the division again. And it was so deflating and the team was not playing well. And then instead of going home for the few days off that you get when you win a division, they had to fly from Seattle to Tampa and start the postseason. And I was like, these guys are cooked. It's not going to happen. And they went on and won a World Series. So every theory that I've ever had, I thought I believed in when it comes to momentum, I will never say it again because I saw it. What I did see was good players. Like, give me good players that are healthy. Like, give me Corey Seager. Give me guys that are going well. Give me Nate Eovaldi and even Max Scherzer. Just good players. Like, take your chances. That's kind of the Dave Dombrowski method, right? He's going to take chances. He's going to bring in big guys with track records. Sometimes you're going to leave a little bit of a mess behind going for it because you're going to get some guys that are older, that are making big money, that are not giving you the production that you want. That's kind of the price of the tax that you pay, if you will. But if what I've learned, and I've been fortunate to play for a long time, do this for a long time now, give you good players, give you them healthy going into the postseason, and quite honestly, I don't even care how they played getting to the postseason, just get there, and then you have that ability to go on a run.
CJ Nikowski, every time I talk to you, it's an absolute pleasure, and I know how nice this is of you to do because you are very busy with all of your duties, especially Braves TV color analyst. There are a lot of baseball games over the course of a year, so my friend, thank you again for being nice enough to make time.
Of course, Bill. Always my pleasure, man.
Appreciate you, buddy. It was great stuff, dude. CJ Nikowski on the show, Atlanta Braves TV color analyst. I got to work with him at Fox Sports 1. He's such a talented guy and such a great guy. Host of Loud Outs on MLB Network Radio. Pitched in the big leagues for 10 years, and he doesn't want to say it, but I will. He dominated Jim Thome The Hall of Famer, 2 of 14 against him, 5 strikeouts, no extra base hits. Let's go! All right. We have an amazing buy or sell coming up with a question that still makes me angry just to think about the answer next year on Writer Than You.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast. Welcome back to Writer Than You.
I'm from Dubuque, Iowa, and the Wall Street Journal did a story over the weekend that said this is the best small town city in America to go to, and it was Dubuque.
No way.
Although, I don't know. Can you be a small town city if you're 80 or 90,000?
I mean, I think we should just be happy that Dubuque, Iowa got some recognition. Why do you have to quibble about small town, medium size?
Because it's not a small town. It's a medium town. Get your stuff together, Journal. Wall Street Journal.
Rip away the honor and give it to a real small town.
That's why they don't call it the Main Street Journal.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
Welcome back into the show. That wasn't bad. A little Main Street, Wall Street joke there. I get it. I got my own jokes a month later. I've lived in a small town. I lived in Chillicothe, Missouri for a summer. That was a really nice summer. That had 9,000 people. That's a small town. When Sonic is the best restaurant in town, there's nothing wrong with Sonic. That's a small town. The best isn't maybe true.
When you went back home a few weeks ago, is there a sign in Dubuque? Voted best small town in America anywhere?
No, they didn't have a sign.
Do they accept the award?
Well, it was just like one person writing it. No. I mean, look, I didn't. It's a big town. It's a medium town. I couldn't scour the whole city. It might have,
You're right. Somewhere buried in the corner somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Could have been there. There's a lot of ways to get in and out of Dubuque. It's not a one-way street in and out.
More than
Why
one
stoplight? Why are you disrespecting my hometown?
No, I'm just asking.
Why are you coming after Dubuque? What is your hometown?
Bayshore, New York.
And do you associate as a person from Bayshore or as a person from Long Island?
I usually say Long Island just because that is more well-known than a small town.
But in your heart, you're just from Bayshore.
I'm a Bayshore guy, of course.
Other Long Island towns.
Well, there's some Long Island towns that have some customers that you don't want to be like.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
There's some tough people on Long Island.
Not even tough. How can I say? I don't even know how to phrase it.
I don't know. I'm not sure what you're saying.
Usually, yeah. Let's just say there's certain towns you think of people certain ways. I like Bayshore.
Got it. I don't know who you're insulting or why, but you're definitely going out for some Long Island.
Oh, I'm definitely insulting people on Long Island for sure.
Yeah. You know what else is for sure? This portion of the program is brought to you by Wesley Financial. Stuck in a timeshare and want out? Contact Wesley Financial Group now and get a free timeshare exit information kit at wesleyfinancialgroup.com.
What side will Bill take on the biggest issues in the world of sports? It's time for today's edition of Buy or Sell on Writer Than You.
Let's start, Bill, with an athlete we unfortunately have not been able to talk about a lot this year.
Okay.
Because she's been hurt. Caitlin Clark.
I know, what a bummer.
Still not playing for the Fever. Regular season winding down. They're hopeful she'll come back, but does not look promising. But nonetheless, her and Nike unveiled yesterday, Bill, her new logo. And also announced a signature shoe is dropping in 2026. Now, Clark will become the third active WNBA player to have a signature shoe, joining Asia Wilson and Sabrina Ionescu. Now, the logo that Clark revealed yesterday is interlocking C's that is supposed to represent how she built her career from the inside out. Marketing. By herself. Caitlin Clark will become the most popular woman athlete ever when it's all said and done.
Sorry. It's a legitimate question. I'm more just put out by the...
Logo description?
I just think the logo is so... The idea of a logo... All right, first of all, buy your thing.
Buy.
I do think she can be. I mean, that's... actually... A little hasty, because Serena...
I was going to say, Serena's like by far the bar, right? Like that's who every female athlete is chasing.
Basketball's bigger than tennis, though. So I think that's where... There's an opportunity to do it. Buy or sell that you agree with me that individual logos are stupid.
Sell.
Oh, come on.
I think depending on the athlete and depending on... I more care about how it looks. Like, I think Tiger Woods' logo is cool. I would buy a Tiger Woods hat or
Nadal's got a logo that's... But I just think the general... Everybody's going to have a logo now.
I will say I like it better in individual sports. Like, Roger... I know he's not playing anymore, but Roger Federer's logo, very clean, very nice. I think for individual players like tennis, golf, it makes more sense than... Like, basketball,
go back in time,
football?
We're going to have a LeBron logo and a Steph logo and a Kobe logo and a Jordan logo and a that's the future. Have a Wembanyama logo. It's just, I don't know. And by the way, her logo's cool. It's cool. I guess.
Like, Steph Curry's logo's fine.
But I don't need logos. I've already got the shoes I have to. I don't buy them. But if you want to, I don't know. I don't know why it annoys me. I just think it's dumb.
Sell.
We'll sell personal logos.
It's not my thing.
So you just want the shoe to be the Caitlin Clark shoe, and it's just whatever she designs it without like any sort of specific logo on it, and I mean, going for all athletes.
It's a money grab, because then they can take a normal white t-shirt and put the logo on there, and then they can charge $100.
I think her t-shirt's dropping either September 1st or October 1st. It is going to, you are right about that. It is going to be the cheapest t-shirt, and it's going to be three digits.
Right.
Crazy.
It's just a money grab.
That's fair. I can't argue with that. You're right about that. You're very right. Do you have a nice Bill Ryder logo?
I'm not going to lie. I was thinking about BR, locked together or something. I don't know, you know? No. That would cost $3. I'll have to pay other people to wear it.
Maybe this player we're going to talk about could have his own logo one day. Arch Manning.
Oh, yeah.
It is game week for Arch as he gets set to take on Ohio State. And yesterday, his head coach, Steve Sarkisian, met the media and discussed his message to Arch ahead of Saturday.
Go be him. You know, that's really our messaging to all of our players, though. You know, you don't have to do anything you've never done before. You don't have to. We're not asking any superhuman efforts of you to do anything that is extraordinary. Just go be you. What you've done is good enough to get us to this point. And to get him to this point in this juncture of his career.
Just be you. So buy or sell, Bill.
Okay.
In order for Texas to win a national title this year, Arch Manning has to be a top five quarterback in college football.
Oh, buy. I think absolutely.
Buy.
Yes.
Speaking.
Buy or sell, if he's the sixth best quarterback in college football. He plays really well, and they lose, you know, somewhere in the college football playoff before the national championship game. People will describe his season as a failure.
Bye.
I'm with you. Which is, that's the challenge for him. Is the standards are so high, and there's no guarantee he can even perform at a high level. I think he will, but it is not a lock.
Not at all. I'm actually worried for him just about that, just what people think. It's crazy.
I was listening to the clip, and I had this horrible premonition of what if the poor guy just throws like a pick on his first drive?
Which, by the way, first time starter on the road against the number
13. Ohio State. Yeah.
It's definitely possible.
It's not. It's the possibility is a non-zero number. Of course it's possible.
And too, like, I know this is like in the weeds, but you look at Texas' offensive line, they lost four starters from last year. What if the O-line stinks?
That's the problem is if their line stinks, his whole season is in trouble.
Right?
Doesn't matter who you are.
I know Texas has good athletes, but still.
Especially in the SEC. Right.
His season could be a quote-unquote failure, and it's not even his fault because he has no help. Or not as good as help as other players. It's very interesting.
It's going to be such a... What time is that game?
Noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
Come on!
You can thank this very network we're about to talk about, Fox. Right. And that is because, according to Front Office Sports, Ohio State has banned Dave Portnoy from entering the stadium on Saturday ahead of Ohio State, Texas. As you can recall, maybe you forgot, Portnoy has teamed up with Fox and Big Noon Kickoff to be a member of their pregame show. He's a very avid, vocal Michigan fan who has taken plenty of shots towards the Buckeyes. And seemingly, reportedly, the Buckeyes are now firing back. But we get more to this story, Bill. This morning, Ohio State AD Ross Bjork was talking to Yahoo Sports, and he claims the decision for Portnoy not to be allowed to enter the stadium was not Ohio State's, but instead Fox's. Buy or sell. If it's true that Ohio State has banned Dave Portnoy from entering the stadium, it is a soft move by Ohio State.
Buy.
Buy.
I know people find Portnoy obnoxious. I actually think he's entertaining, which took me a long time to get to, by the way. But whether you like him or you don't like him, there are so many unlikable people in media and likable people. People take shots. You can't ban him. I know he's a fan, but you can't ban him from your facilities when there's a live broadcasting thing going on. I have a question. I just got my ninth spam call on my cell phone today. Buy or sell, there's anything I can do about this?
Buy.
What can I do?
I think after the show, you should Google, basically, I am getting inundated with spam calls. What can I do? I think there has to be some sort of national do not call number. Something's off. Everyone that gets spam calls, I get maybe one a day, two or three a week. The fact you've got nine?
Now there's a tenth one coming in.
No way.
Yes.
In like, what, 3 hours we're talking? You're basically in, what, three an hour?
Yeah.
There's definitely, that's not normal. There's definitely a way out of it, for sure.
Brutal.
Okay. So I'm going to call, something to look up. I think you definitely get out of it. That is insane. Maybe get a new number. Screw it. Get out of that.
I've had this number forever.
And I guess clearly telemarketers know that, or the spam artists know that. Your number is somewhere on the dark web.
It is.
Holy
it is
cow. Out there. Holy cow. Sticking with football, Bill, when it comes to holdouts in the NFL, we usually see a domino effect of once the first contract gets signed, usually then we see others follow suit. Yesterday, we saw two contracts happen pretty quickly. Commanders Terry McLaurin agreed to a new deal, and Trey Hendrickson and the Bengals then a few hours later agreed to a new deal here for 2025, doubling the salary of the All-Pro. Two of the three deals already done. The big one left, Micah Parsons and the Cowboys. Buy or sell, Bill. Two of the three deals getting done yesterday gives you confidence that by the time week one rolls around, a week from Thursday, Micah Parsons will have a new deal with Dallas.
All right, sell. I will say this.
Sell.
I knew those deals would get done. I think we all knew those deals would get done. And this is an interesting dilemma for you because you helped me figure out what we're going to talk about in the show. And as you can tell the audience, buy or sell, it's true. Even when it's significant, I often roll my eyes at the storylines of these holdouts.
Buy.
Because I know their deals are going to get done. I know that Trey Hendrickson should have been practicing. I mean, go down the list of all these guys. The deals always get done. Even Dax got done 2 years ago when it was game day, right?
Like literally 2 hours before kickoff last year is when he signed
last
the deal and got
last
it done.
Year, last year,
it was
last
nuts.
Year. The Micah Parsons thing is different because it's been so unprofessional in how things have been communicated, in my opinion, by Jerry Jones, that the toxicity is so public that maybe a deal doesn't get done, but I still think a deal is going to get done. But my confidence is not the normal. Normally, I would have zero doubt. And now it feels like it's maybe 60-40 a deal gets done, which is just crazy to me.
Jerry Jones for you. That is Jerry Jones. So speaking of, or sticking with, maybe is a better way to say it, Trey Hendrickson, right? He did not get the long-term security he was looking for in a deal, but did earn a $14 million raise here for 2025 to bring his total compensation to $30 million. Now, the Athletic's Dino Rossini reported yesterday that the All-Pro turned down a three-year, $96 million offer from Cincinnati because did not have any guarantees beyond year one. Buy or sell? You would be shocked if Trey Hendrickson is on the Bengals in 2026.
Buy.
Buy.
This feels like the final hurrah, doesn't it?
Yes. We'll pay you now. Hopefully have a great year. Hopefully win it all. And we'll best of luck going forward.
Here's why for anyone who doesn't understand where I'm coming from. If the Bengals are unwilling to pay a guy that had 17.5 sacks last year because he's 30 years old, guaranteed money, they're going to be even less willing to do it next year when he's 31 years old. Regardless of how, he's not going to have 50 sacks. I mean, what? He's not going to surpass that season. And maybe he will, but it'll be in the. He was already one of the best pass rushers in football last year. He accounted for half their sacks last season. So, no, I think this is goodbye. Buy or sell, he should be a Bear.
Buy.
Great answer.
Play into the crowd.
Yeah, you are.
Speaking of playing to the crowd, maybe that's what the Browns did in keeping Shedeur Sanders on their roster. Basically, it's all but official. He'll be a Brown in 2025. As yesterday, Cleveland cut Tyler Huntley. Then later on in the night, traded Kenny Pickett to the Raiders, leaving three quarterbacks on the roster. Joe Flacco, Dylan Gabriel, and Shedeur Sanders seemingly in that order. Buy or sell, Bill? Shedeur Sanders will start at least three games for the Browns in 2025.
Oh, wow. That's a sell for me. I don't think so.
Sell.
I mean, I can't. I'm not anticipating both Joe Flacco and Dylan Gabriel getting injured, which obviously is not impossible. But what? Worst case scenario, right? Flacco's bad. He gets four games. And then at that point, Dylan Gabriel, I think, as it goes the rest of the way. They don't think Shador's ready, and so they clearly don't think that he's ready. And so I don't think they'll throw him out there. By the way, I don't think you want it. You don't want to see Shedeur Sanders if you're a Shedeur fan. I discussed this earlier. The last thing you want is Shedeur to get exposed in a real NFL game and be awful just for the sake of his confidence and his development.
It's going to be interesting, though, if Dylan Gabriel struggles, too. Look, he's looked fine in the preseason.
He might, though.
He might. A team's not very good around him. Then all of a sudden, it's a month of bad Dylan Gabriel. You know what's going to be chanting out in Cleveland, or maybe around the country. Start your door. It's going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it'll be everywhere.
Speaking of interesting, let's finish here, Bill. Cal Raleigh keeps on chugging for the Mariners. He hit his 50th homer of the season, becoming the first switch hitter in MLB history with 50 or more homers before the month of September. Now, the AL record for homers in a season is 62, set by Aaron Judge a few years ago. Mariners, for their season, 30 games left. Raleigh, right now, if he plays every game the rest of the way, is projected to hit 63 homers. Buy or sell? You are rooting for Cal Raleigh to break the AL home run record.
Sell.
Sell.
I don't want anyone to break home run records anymore, because then I just don't believe in them. Super unfair. Totally unfair.
Wow.
Totally unfair.
So you hope Aaron Judge at 62 stays for the rest of your lifetime?
Sure.
Is it you don't want it to break, or you don't care if it is broken?
It's more I don't care.
Okay. That's fine. That's fair.
Once a guy hit 70 and then I had to not like it because it turned out, whatever.
Do you at least buy that this, Judge is 62, this run here by Cal Raleigh is not like the Mark McGwire 70
I don't know how to answer that. I want to believe that that's accurate. I think that's accurate. No one ever did it. And then everybody did it because they cheated, and then they got caught, and then everybody could do it again. Okay, I don't really know. Wow.
You're trusting
me skeptical. Color me skeptical.
Once you do it one time, the trust is never fully back.
Right. I've never been cheated on in a relationship, but I would imagine that would alter the way you go about interpreting everything, right?
I would assume so.
Yeah, I would assume so, too. We don't.
Is quite the depressing way.
Infidelity. Sell.
Sell.
Yeah, my bad. All right. I want to talk more about this Dave Portnoy story and just my excitement, the general excitement for college football season. So we'll do that after we get a sports flash from Gordon Damer.
Infinity Sports Network. Sports Flash.
Bill, the Turk is the nickname given to a team staff member on NFL teams that's the bearer of bad news and tells players that they have been cut. Today is cut down day around the NFL. Teams have to get their rosters down to 53 players by 4 p.m. Eastern. Some recognizable names looking for work. KJ Osborne released by the Commanders today. The Bengals cut loose Desmond Ridder. Isaiah Simmons, he was released by the Packers. Tommy DeVito, given the axe by the Giants. Deontay Johnson, released by the Browns. He signed a one-year deal with Cleveland for the veteran minimum that had no guaranteed money. It's his fourth team in just the last 2 years. Also, Mecole Hardman, he was cut by the Packers. The Titans, they didn't cut Tajay Spears, but they will be without the running back for the first four games of the season. Placed on injured reserve to start the year because of that high ankle sprain. Day three at the National Tennis Center. And the U.S. Open rolling on. Men's defending champ Jannik Sinner. He'll play his opening round match a little later this afternoon. I'm Gordon Damer.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast.
Welcome back into the show. Bill Ryder with you. The Defensive Player of the Week is sponsored by the Navy Federal Credit Union, who proudly serves the Armed Forces, DOD veterans, and their families. Their members are the mission. Learn more at NavyFederal.org. Pirates ace Paul Skeens dominated again on Sunday afternoon, tossing seven innings of shutout ball while striking out seven in Pittsburgh's 4-0 win over the Rockies. For the season, Skeens has the lowest ERA in baseball at 2.07 and is the heavy betting favorite to win the Cy Young Award. That dude is amazing. Is it possible he is the most mesmerizing player in sports right now? He doesn't get that level of attention, but who is more, that's playing right now, right? Who is more remarkable than this guy? Current athletes. Mahomes is kind of steady as it goes.
I think Ohtani, in part because he's pitching again.
Okay, that's a good one.
And we haven't seen it for 2 years, and now it's on a new team. I would I think it's the only issue, not issue, but we are a societal issue, is that we get bored very quickly. So, like, last year, Paul Skeens, I think, was extremely captivating. And you could argue maybe this time last year was the most riveting player in all of sports. But then we see it. And even though he's just even more dominant now in year two, it's like, okay, well, I know Paul Skeens really good. What's next? And there are very few athletes that you could say are still captivating despite you kind of having that what's next feeling.
It's amazing how dominant he is. And he's on a bad baseball team, by the way.
With no run support, which is a shame.
Normally, I would wish him to stay, and I like Pittsburgh as a community, but if they're not going to invest money, you almost have to get rid of the guy, don't you? I mean, you root for him to be somewhere else. I mean, if you're not, by the way, he's not, I just looked this up. Would you like to guess if he finishes the season with his current earned run average, it will be the what lowest earned run average by a starter this century, if you want to guess?
2.07. I will say it would be the fifth lowest.
14th.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's some
dogs
in that.
There, I mean, Kershaw is in there several times. Verlander, Pedro, Bauer. Remember Trevor Bauer could play?
That's right.
Greinke. The original Biebs, Shane Bieber.
But he had some good years.
Only 12 guys this century have had a sub 2.0 earned run average.
Which is, for 30 starts, is crazy.
It's crazy, dude. By the way, some of this is a misnomer because the original Biebs pitched 12 games. Trevor Bauer, 11 games. Dallas Keuchel and Yu Darvish, 11 and 12 games, respectively. So if you eliminate, if you require, you know, 18, no, let's just say 20 games pitched, right? You're taking off taking off four of those guys. So now you're talking top 10 season.
Incredible. I feel like
and I think that's a better standard. No, it's not. It's a historic level. It's a historic level of excellence. I just don't want him to be a Yankee or a Dodger. I want him to go to, maybe he can go to another small market like the Chicago Cubs.
Oh, just randomly pick one out of my head. Let's see. Put the media market aside. Just
thinking on. Randomly thinking on.
Those Cubs pinstripes, right? They look really good on him.
So Portnoy's not going to be able to be in Columbus, and there's another report out there that he's not going to be welcomed into any of the Big Ten venues, stadiums this year. What is the upside if you're, what are you doing if you're, here's the thing. If you're the Big Ten, don't you just want to sell the product? You might hate the guy, but he is going to be, his organization, he founded Barstool, he is Barstool, is going to be one of the critical components of talking about branding, selling, spreading the message of Big Ten football. Just deal with it.
I get what you're saying. I'm not trying to defend them. This is not a defense. I think this is maybe just trying to look at it from a different, or like trying to see through what are they really mad about. I don't think they're mad about that he's a Michigan fan. I think they're mad at Fox. I think they hate Big Noon Kickoff.
Yeah, you think it's part of it's just why are we doing this at 11 Central Time?
And like, you already signed the contract. I mean, you're getting a lot of money to do it. So it's like you can't really, There's nothing you can
do. The time's awful.
The time's terrible.
Think if you're USC.
You're 14.
They play on the West Coast.
You have four teams. Fourth of your conference. You're talking about 9 a.m. local time kicks.
Oregon, right.
That's crazy. That's not good for anybody.
Zach Gelb tweeted something last night that I thought was spot on. The big winner of this is Dave Portnoy. It's just attention. He doesn't need to be. He already won. You're not punishing him. You're rewarding him.
And in a way, too, probably Fox wins in the sense of now if you are a College Game Day like diehard, maybe you're more intrigued. Is he going to go in the stadium or not? What's the kind of reaction going to be?
That's true.
For Saturday morning, I bet your ratings will go up.
What stupid show on? Is it on at 8 my time?
I think it's a two-hour show, so I believe it's at 7.
7? Ugh. I mean, now I might get up for it. I don't want to be up for it. I'd rather roll out of bed at 8:15, have some coffee, be pissed off at the universe, and then watch football.
9 a.m. is tough. I hate the London game for the NFL, and that's 9 a.m. my time. I mean, 6 hours.
I watch it on repeat. I watch it on skip. Some it depends on the game, but normally the games aren't very good.
Can I say I'm crazy really fast?
Yeah.
Is there such a thing as too much football?
Not yet. Although I think that if I'm a big believer that if they ever went to football 7 days a week, it would severely damage how special the game feels.
Do you think with that London game where it's like 9 a.m. to like almost midnight? That's too much.
But those games are usually garbage, so you don't have to worry about it.
True.
Oh, I'm gonna miss Jags Raiders.
Damn
I'll
it!
I'll have to get over it. It's gonna be tough. I guess I'll sleep in. Thank you to CJ Nikowski. Great work as always by Ryan Hickey. I'm Bill Ryder. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you. We'll see you back here tomorrow on Ryder Than You.